piercingly blue-eyed, stridently politically correct, educated in cultural theory, traveled, smart. Emma is lovely and strange, and the only thing stranger than her is her fish novel. But when I say strange, I mean expectation-defying. I mean brilliant, but not in an irritating or I want to punch her lights out kind of way. I mean the kind of brilliant you want to root for, the kind of, that makes you cheer with her every accomplishment. Go to emmaemmaemma.com, and what you might notice is how her fiction has gone viral. You might notice how her stories make your brain catch fire. She creates worlds where psychics walk among us as regular people, and girls fight crime and wear gloves, where Spanish teachers and punks train for the apocalypse, where dead girls come to life in freezers, only to reveal they were never really dead, only to reveal they were dead all along. Sisters go missing, the rains finally end, birds are encountered, moose terrify. Her fiction blends the natural with the fantastical and psychological, the weird and the girlish. A few weeks ago, Emma left our nonfiction workshop worried she wasn't enough of a geek to write good literature. But ask Emma how she spent her weekend. She will probably say she has done nothing productive. If you press her for details, she will tell you how she's cooked 3 pots of stew, 1 beef, 1 veggie, and 1 chili. How long will it take me to eat 3 pots of stew, she asks, one of life's great questions. When Emma says she has done nothing, she means that she has spent all day crying over the blog of Emily Rapp, who she finds devastating and insightful. Or she has learned a song on the guitar. She draws, she writes poetry. She's read both Kelly Link collections and the latest Kate Atkinson novel, and that was just on Saturday. She watches YouTube videos of kittens. She is hopelessly and unapologetically behind the times. Her celebrity crush is the pre-adolescent incarnation of actor-writer Strong of the 90s show Boy Meets World. Her favorite television series is Supernatural, and last semester Emma discovered online television. She reads about mafia pushing whippets at fish concerts. She reads fan fictions. She follows the blog of MIT professor Henry Jenkins, the world's only scholar of fan fiction. Emma, if all of these things don't make you a geek, I don't know what does. Meet Emma. She's thoughtful. She'll call you on your shit. She'll eat your leftovers. She is open and warm. She brings tenderness, insight, and compassion to her characters. She brings love of the strange and fantastical to her stories. She is ever generous. Her fiction is self-aware, and it's hard to imagine someone more equipped to write the kind of stories we will stay up late to finish. It's a pleasure to introduce her.
Short ones instead. One sort of longer one that's just still pretty short, and then like 2 pieces of flash fiction. First, though, I'm going to embarrass myself and read a poem. Because I'm reading with Joanna Klink, and I'm a big fan of her work. I don't know if you're here, Joanna, but I love your poems. and I wrote a poem around a line from a poem that she wrote called Some Feel Rain. The line that I really liked was, a place so safe it can't be snapped. I thought that was really beautiful. I have to keep reminding myself to breathe, sorry guys. I'm so nervous, I've never done this before. Okay, so it doesn't really have a title, it was just written. around that line. So I'm not a poet, please bear with me. Don't talk to me about this afterwards. A Place So Safe It Can't Be Snapped. I guess that's kind of the title, but it's not really, because I didn't ask her for it. Anyway. I was on an airplane. I was sleeping. I was tricked to calmness by the ready arms of land. If I could knit the sea, I'd knit it shut. The world's been keeping secrets from me. The world has taken off its glasses. It doesn't want to see its food. I used to wish to be a picky eater, believing it a sign of grace, like how some girls are loved because they're quiet. But I was never quiet, always hungry. And now I chew the edges of my blankets till I'm left unclothed. What covered us is deep inside. But what I wouldn't eat, wood. What I wouldn't drink, glass. I'm not afraid to die alone, but I'm scared of being weak all by myself. Perhaps there is no other way. Otherwise, we'd call it strong. By which I mean our fists meet air. If I could be a rooster in a ring, I would grow teeth and be a girl again, and then I'd step on all the eggs. The only way to beat it is to take it back. Please take it back. Be a tongue and unsay. Or if the darkness underneath us isn't water, please hold my hands and pray it has a name. Okay, the end of that. This is the longer of the short stories. I'm gonna try to read it slow, so I read for an acceptable amount of time. Timed this morning, it was 16 minutes, so, but I'm talking too much in between, so let's 19. Okay. Kids or kids? I wake up the first morning of my visit, and I think I'm hearing children being mowed down by an unrepentant hand. But instead, I find a chorus line of goats outside the window. Why, they bawl. Why? It is remarkable how quick the otherworldly settles into commonplace when it awakens you at 5 a.m. from jet-lagged vital sleep. Kids are kids, my sister asks. We are walking down her road. It's all red dust and shreds of black trash bags like seaweed. And white tiled walls. What I think of when I think of hot and foreign. The sound is always close, like an open-mouthed heartbeat, and a group of boys runs past us holding sticks and shrieking down a backwards glancing dog. Kids, I say, pointing. Don't you love this game, she says. You can't be wrong. The dog is not running very fast. One of its hind legs is bleeding. I don't foresee a happy ending. At the end of the narrow dirt street is a wide dirt street. Most of the cars that pass are taxis. On the corner, we buy phone credit to call our father in Wisconsin from a man whose stand is also selling mangoes and shelled peanuts. To Bob, the man calls me. My sister he calls Aminata, which is not the name I know for her. They speak to one another, grinning, all the while gesturing at me. The sun is raw gold and heavy as a paperweight. When we were little girls, my sister would do anything I said, and all my memories of being small are how it felt to never drop her hand. On speakerphone, my father tells us, just remember, safety is a mindset. He is pretending to be calm. Both of us here. Historically, his dread has room for one daughter at a time. Last winter, when my car spun out on Highway 8 and I was in the hospital for weeks, the Gambia took on the placid soundness of a Midwest cornfield. But as soon as it was clear that I'd recover, he remembered how to panic about sickness and political unrest, and began again to write my sister emails full of tips, like when to sanitize her toothbrush. Now his girls are side by side, and whatever strikes the one will get the other too. I don't believe in anything so mindful. In my car, with all the glass and blood mosaicked on the street, I learned the arbitrary hinges of the body can come loose at any time. I want this to feel like a vacation, my sister says. I want you to have the full experience, but also I want you to relax. She hails a cab with an imperious hand. Taxis are the same everywhere. The driver tries to overcharge. He's bummed out that my sister speaks the language and knows which price is fair. so we go 20 blocks for only 6 American cents. Fair and not fair. 3 years, that's how long she's lived here. For my visit, she's taken time off work. She works at a sustainable oyster harvesting women's organization. A sustainable women harvesting oysters organization, I say. She manages a smile. Because she is so serious, she's daring. She trusts herself to manage the world and trusts the world to play by rules. The way I feel, and it hasn't helped me out much in the past, is that every puddle's deeper than it looks, and every mouth has sharper teeth than mine. What I find funny is the silly danger of it all. Like how some people put their hands around each other's throats for pleasure, or how an inch of water is enough to drown you, death by soup. We get out at the end of the land. Despite the trash that fills the streets like after New Year's confetti, the ocean looks clean as an eye. Some of the houses on the beach have those white tile walls, and some are made of tin and driftwood. There are muscular young men in Speedos doing exercises on the sand. Showing off the goods, my sister says, to coax money from old horny white ladies. The goods are good. Worth a fancy dinner at least, if I were that kind of lonely. There's a man I've been sleeping with, though he is very far away in general. Sometimes when we're together, I feel pushed outside my body. My sister says we'll meet her friends tomorrow. She tells me some of them are Gambian, but most are young and white like us. I fill in the blanks. They work for acronyms. They keep redefining why they're here. The water is hard, sugar green, and rough with salt, cold. We get in all the way. It's not so scary after all, is it? She says. She floats with her feet to the open ocean. I float looking towards the beach. The palm trees are skinnier and taller than I've seen in pictures. So tall, I am surprised at how stable they seem, rooted in the sand. I wasn't scared, I say. It took you 3 years to get here. I have news for you, I say. Waitressing is not the lucrative profession it once was. Sure, she says, and slides under the water as if she's going down a drain. Her long hair comes to the surface. What does she know about fear? Afraid to die is one thing, an arm or a leg. We are always already dead. Worse is the fear that comes when someone tells you to hang on, there's hope. I'm not saying there's no hope. I'm saying don't put it on me. My seatmate on the plane last night was Gambian, a banker. We talked about California, a place neither of us have been, and he didn't try to marry me. This gave me a false impression of the men here. Walking back from the beach, 6 have stopped us in the street to propose. One of them promises me a lifetime supply of peanuts, and I get excited until my sister tells me that the peanuts here cause cancer. I don't want your nuts, I say to him. I prefer American nuts. My sister pulls me away. She knows I can't stop when I think I'm being funny. A crowd comes towards us down the street, shouting and kicking and sending tawny dust into the air. It takes a moment for me to notice that all of them are men. My sister says, "'Tis the season," and herds me into a Western Union. The woman behind the counter is talking on her cell phone and raises one drawn-on eyebrow when she sees us and jerks her thumb towards the window. See that guy in the leaves, my sister says? I do. The epicenter of the men. There's no part of his body that is visible. He's head to toe in vegetation, what looks like rushes strapped to every piece of him, like thick, ropey hair. He looks like a Muppet, except he's double-fisting a machete. That's a conqueror, my sister says. They throw machetes at women. I say, excuse me? During circumcision season. This conqueror is more for show, but in the bush you should be in your hut before dark. I knew a Peace Corps volunteer who got nicked in the heel because she didn't make it away fast enough. I'm trying to be culturally open, I say. The other men have machetes too and are striking them together like rough bells and laughing. The woman behind the counter is off the phone now, watching the procession with us. They turn a corner and their noise follows with them. The woman says, I tell my husband yesterday I would like to be Conqueror. Dress me up like that, no one will know. Turns out there's only one kind of beer produced in this entire country. A one-horse town indeed. We drink it in the shaded backyard of a pub called the Scottish Embassy. And my sister tells me how, when the place first opened, there was a line of Gambians around the block trying to get visas into Scotland. Our waiter confirms this. He was second in line. He's laughing, so I feel all right laughing too. You got burned, my sister says, and puts her bottle down to touch my cheek. Her fingers are cold and wet from condensation. In the hospital, there was a nurse I mistook for her, that same soft face. The nurse let me hold her hand until my head cleared and I could see that she was middle-aged and Japanese. Her fingers, too, were cold and wet from putting ice chips on my tongue. Now my sister's talking to our waiter in the language she has learned. Her voice is higher than it is in English. Beyond the iron gates of the pub, a goat pauses and stares at me with eyes like foreign coins. Here's looking at you, kid. Or, kid. It seems to me you can't be right. I'm going to read two more pieces. They're both exactly 500 words. River traffic. The river by Anne's house, the Clark Fork, was swollen up with people. It was the first day of true summer heat, the sun at last arrival to the bite of mountain snowmelt that made the water inhospitable to all but the most dedicated of recreators. Now there was a winding line of black inner tubes, bumping up against one another like drunken turtles. Anne watched out the window. The floaters writhed palely atop the tubes, shrieking, splashing, the blank sun glinting off their skin. Her daughter at the table was annoyed. She was 25, dressed in white, recently engaged. The fiancé was in the bathroom and had been running the water for nearly half an hour. He was good-looking, but haunted by fear of hair loss. Anne last night had heard the frantic creaking of the bed from down the hall in Eliza's old room, and all morning had been wanting to make a joke about her daughter's virginal white dress, but was holding her tongue. She did not want to invite a lecture. Eliza was strict about such things. The fiancé came out from the bathroom at last, gingerly toweling his head. He had put on a pink button-up t-shirt, and Anne thought he looked like a handsome child, his cheeks splotched from the shower. He went to the window and asked about the floaters, and Eliza said it was the same thing every summer, noisy river traffic, beer cans thrown straight into the water to wash up on shore alongside foamy dead fish. You used to love to float the river, Anne said. That was then, Eliza said. Anne set plates of eggs on the table, repeating the word then to herself. They started to eat, the fiancé glancing out the window occasionally. Then. It was amazing how much derision Eliza could pack into one word. The fiancé, by contrast, seemed utterly benign, putting eggs into his mouth with a dumb and focused expression. Well, Anne thought, lots of men like to be bossed around. Her own ex-husband had, before he hadn't. But even Anne had never been as domineering as Eliza, never. When she was 5, Eliza had been discovered playing horsey with a neighbor boy, sitting on his back and whipping him repeatedly with a belt, crying, "Giddy up!" She had made him bleed. Anne found herself relating this story to the breakfast table. The fiancé was laughing. He had bright, even teeth of the braces generation. Anne laughed too, uncertainly. She'd meant it to be a funny story, hadn't she? Though at the time, she had not found it funny, not at all. At the time, it was Eliza's father who had laughed, and they'd had a fight about it. It was strange, Anne thought, how stories changed over time, how they picked up and shed meaning, so you were never certain what it was that you were saying, yet there was nothing to do but keep on telling them. That one's done. Dwelling. There's a sound like crickets coming from my toilet. I wondered at first if maybe a family of them had nested in the pipes. But really what happened is there's just something wrong. In a different life, I'd care, except the house is foreclosed and I've been given 30 days notice to move out. It's the third time I've been evicted in the past 2 years. I keep moving into cheap houses, like maybe the crumbled falling down look is just an act. It's about money, though I've been thinking that maybe it's not about money. I mean, it could be a sign. My mother would say it's clear that I want to be kicked out. That's why I don't speak to my mother. She is always telling me what I want. House, I say to it, what do you want? The house shows me that it's desperate to succumb to itself, little pieces of it failing every day. Its water-damaged walls are soft as rotting gums, and last night, during the wind, I heard shingles sliding off the roof, like a sore throat. I wonder if my downstairs neighbors feel like I do, ashamed. But there are two of them, and only one of me, though both my managers at work are under the impression that I have a 3-year-old daughter. They believe her name is Madeline. What's worse, I told them she has cystic fibrosis. I said she sleeps in an iron lung, and every morning I have to pound her back with cupped hands to help her spit the mucus up. I only lied about the daughter part, or at least the part where I'm the mother. Lies don't come easy to me, despite what you may think. I surprised myself with that one. But working at a liquor store, all I hear is tales of woe. There's a man who's missing both his eyes and both his hands, and had a surgery to separate the bones of his arms, so now he has 2 enormous fleshy pinchers, which he uses to hold plastic flasks of Evan Williams. So I guess I felt unjustified in my unhappiness. Now everyone asks about my daughter. How's the kid, they say? How's the rugrat? I say, every day's a struggle, but she's really hanging in there. At this point, it's a game. I answer like they're asking about me. I tell them she's pretty whiny when she doesn't get exactly what she wants, but all in all, her attitude is good. It's an inside joke with myself. We laugh and laugh, me and me. Except sometimes I wake up at night and feel I'm under dirty water. My lungs struggle to inflate. I wonder if an illness can be conjured like a spirit, if it's separate from the housing body, or if a body isn't like a house at all, if it's a stone, one heavy sinking thing. Thank you.